From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Each year, the powers that be in the horticulture industry declare what the trends are, what color is in, and what design styles we're all meant to adhere to, and what plant is hot or not. Today's guest and I beg to differ and have decided to do some trend declarations of our own, from big bold perennials to why you should learn to propagate and share some plants. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
Dr. Jared Barnes is an associate professor of horticulture at Stephen F. Austin State University in Texas and the creator of the Planted blog and e-newsletter and the monthly Plantastic podcast. He's been gardening since about age 5, and I'm so glad to welcome him here today to do some forecasting together. How are you?
I'm great, Margaret. How are you today?
Good to meet you finally. I'm okay.
It is wonderful to meet you too.
Yeah, we have so many friends in common and plants in common.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I also want to say thank you so much for all that you put into the world to make the world more fantastic.
Oh,
so
well, I've been subscribing to your e-newsletter, which I enjoy very much, and reading more and more of your blog. So it's mutual. So, a little background. You just tell us quickly, you teach horticulture and where do you garden? Do you have a garden, a home garden?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I live in East Texas. I am a professor at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. We're a nice school. We've got about 12,000 students. And of those, we have a lot of students interested in plants. And so I also oversee our horticulture program and our student botanic garden, The Plantery, where we, attract and bring in passionate, talented students to help us celebrate plants with the community. So it's definitely fun. And then I live about 20 minutes outside of town, and my wife and I have a 2.5-acre homestead called Ephemera Farm, where we celebrate the small moments of life, that make life worth living. So we've got beautiful wildflowers that bloom in the spring, the stalwarts of summer, and then, of course, fall interest that leads into winter interest as well, too. So we live there about 5-6 years now. So it's definitely been fun to sort of start from scratch, bare soil, and build a garden from that.
That's great.
Thank you.
I read a recent post you did on your blog about the naming of the place, Ephemera Farm. Very Buddhist. I loved it. Celebrating.
Thank you.
Because, as they say, nothing lasts,
That is true.
Nothing lasts. And and holding on too tight, pretending it will, is not going to get you anywhere. So in the intro, I promised we'd announce Jared and Margaret's 2023 garden trends. the heck with the industry's list, but not really. There's plenty of good ones on the industry list. It's just that, I have other things I want to shout out to people, and I know you do too.
Yes.
But maybe we should start by predicting that you can't predict the weather anymore. I think, last week between Saturday, I was -14 and +54. And I think
goodness.
You Texans have had some disturbing cold snaps yourself. Yes,
we have. So 2 years ago at our house it's basically now 2 year anniversary, because it was Valentine's Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We got down to -6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And at our house in East Texas, we live a little bit outside of the town. So here in town, it was only like -3. But the thing to take away from that is that we're normally 8B and we were 6A. For at least 8 hours, we were below zero, for at least 8 hours, because I checked before I went to bed at midnight and it was already below zero. So, and then back before Christmas, we were 9 degrees Fahrenheit. So, I definitely see that as we go forward in the future, we're going to have to start thinking about plants that are more resilient. For us here in East Texas, we've got a lot of broadleaf evergreens that have now had 2 rough winters out of 3 years. And last winter, You know, we had a very dry spell, and so a lot of our spring ephemerals took a long time to emerge. You know, I thought it was going to be forever until bloodroot emerged. So yeah, trying to find plants that are more resilient in landscapes is definitely something we're going to have to look more into.
Yeah. So a trend I know that we both want to see come true, because I've read, again, your blog and newsletter and so forth, is big perennials. So yes. Tell me about some of your big perennials. What's a big perennial?
Well, a big perennial is a plant that achieves some mass throughout some point in the growing season. So this could be early on. And for me, I do try to strive to have some of those in my garden, like Baptisia alba. You know, some of the Baptisias, we have actually Baptisias here in Texas that get 6-7 feet tall easily. And so in April, you know, when the garden is just getting up and getting going, having that early mass is really good. But the other thing too is that with these big perennials, I think especially with more interest in naturalistic design and doing this, you know, design plant communities, we need these primary plants, these anchors in the landscape, to make sure that we have interest and things that we can kind of hold throughout the season, so that that way people have, you know, multi-season interest on some of these species. So that's one of the reasons I love Baptisia so much, is that, you know, you get those early spring flowers, you then have this, you know, stemmy mass of plant tissue that lasts on into the fall. For us in East Texas, Baptisias tend to start going dormant actually in early September. So, you know, they kind of start to fade away then, but then you're left with these beautiful pods that are left behind for winter interest. And the other thing too that I love about these is that I don't think a lot of people appreciate this about Baptisia and the wild indigos, but they have this tumbleweed action where, you know, when we get those stiff December winds that start coming through, Baptisia will start breaking off at the base.
Kind
of tumble. I know, it's a brilliant seed dispersal mechanism, right? You know, so it's a great way to kind of spread your seeds around, just tumble along, and just kind of every time you hit the ground, knock a few out. So
cool. Yeah. I started with big perennials maybe 35 years ago was what I was most attracted to. So with big foliage, like for us, Astolboides and its relative Rogersia. I have some late bloomer. You were just talking about a big bulb thing that happens early, which is wonderful. And I, Lespedeza thunbergii, the bush clover, and that could just get to be this massive, almost looks like a shrub, but it's herbaceous.
Yes.
And it can be purple or white flowers, and the insects really love it, and so forth. The native goat's beard that we have, and I don't know how far south it goes, Aruncus dioecus, or however you say it.
Yeah.
Boy, that gets to be also like a shrub. And we have a native spikenard and Aurelia racemosa, that also, it takes on shrub stature, and flowers and fruits and so forth, big insect attractor and native. You know, it takes on shrub stature, even though it's herbaceous, dies to the ground in the winter here. So, you know, yeah, those are some great ones. And then there's one from the Pacific Northwest in Northern California. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Darmera peltata.
I've heard of it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Like these umbrellas on these giant stems, almost like well over thigh, maybe hip high, and these big umbrella, green umbrellas on top. And, you know, just really fun. So, yeah, lots of good big. I love, that's my thing, is big perennials, definitely.
Awesome. Yeah. And then another one that I love here is Rebeckia maxima.
Yes.
The giant coneflower. And so for us in East Texas, it's actually like a four season plant, because for us, it never truly goes dormant in the wintertime, even if it gets knocked back pretty hard. Oh. So you have that beautiful glaucous green blue foliage throughout most of the wintertime to enjoy.
No, I don't, Jared.
Well, at least we do. At least we do. So, yes. But I mean, so I grew up in Tennessee, and, you know, even for my parents, it would die back to the ground every year and then reemerge in the spring. But yeah, for us, a lot of times when we do our January mowbacks and cutbacks, you know, we've already got foliage up, and we'll just cut it to the ground and it pops back up. But, you know, I was amazed how thick it gets in the ditches here. Like, I mean, there's ditches out by where I live, and literally it's just solid Rebeckia maxima for probably 100 feet. So, yes. Yeah.
Oh, huh. You know, we have the big Joe Pye weeds at late in the season as well. And we have a Vernonia, an ironweed, which even is called New York ironweed, and Nova borescensis, Vernonia Nova borescensis. And that gets to be, like way tall. Fun bloomers. So lots of those sort of prairie-ish plants, prairie plants that are statuesque too.
Yes.
I think, yeah. So big plants, we want to say to people, put them into your landscape because they give a different impact, visual impact, right? They break it up, don't they?
Yeah, they do. You know, they definitely provide some oomph in your landscape. So yeah, if you have big perennials, some things to think about are, a lot of times people like to locate them more towards the back of beds or the back of plantings, but that doesn't mean that you can't put one up front for like impact. You know, it's kind of almost like a random planting. And the other thing too is that some of them do respond to early season cutback, where you kind of go in and just cut the foliage down, maybe sort of do that Chelsea chop, and then that can help to prevent some floppage later on in the growing season.
Yeah. So here, the reason it's called Chelsea chop is because it is usually done in the UK around the time of the Chelsea Flower Show in May. So it's sort of like when things are part way up, you cut them back maybe by a half or a third. And it works great for things like a lot of the aster relatives and even sedum, the big tall sedums, and lots of other things. But, you know, so you get a little later, the bloom begins, and but at a more, a little bushier and a little less tall of a height. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And then the other thing too, that we deal with here in the Deep South, is that because we do have such a long growing season and things can get so dry, we tend to start having plants that kind of show, you know, what they call the neck and knees, where it's like, it's kind of like knee height and lower, or waist height and lower. You have basically open stem tissue.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of times crinkly, almost dead foliage. And so, you know, sometimes a nice cutback in May kind of stunts that plant back and lets it get fuller and bushier. That way it can grow better and then look more cleaner later on in the growing season.
Okay. Yeah. So we could talk about big plants for a long time, but let's just move on. Amy, when we emailed and communicated the other day, you were predicting a few other hot trends of 2023. what else do you have on your list?
Well, one of the things that I had on the list was carnivorous plants.
Yes.
Because I don't know if this has ever been on a trends list, but they are hot, because one of the things I love about working with students is that you can always see what people gravitate toward and what they're very interested in. And so, you know, some of the more tropical pitcher plants like Nepenthes, but then of course we can't forget our natives as well too. And so one of the things we're working on here is trying to get more diversity of some of our native species, like, you know, Sarracenia alata, which is one of our native pitcher plants, Sarracenia rosea. Getting seed of these and then actually teaching students how to germinate them and then grow them on, you know, because if you've got carnivorous plants, I mean, they sell like hotcakes, as, you know, the plethora of people on Instagram can share and talk about.
Yes, it's definitely a collector's thing. It's like this, and even as a sort of quote houseplant, even as an offshoot of the sort of houseplant craze, there are people who are, you know, like that great nursery, California Carnivores, that's been in business forever and out on the West Coast, and, you know, that sell, and they sell them not just for planting out in the landscape, but they're great for making like a, if you have a wet area of your garden, like a boggy kind of area, or a really wonderful for those types of spots in the garden as well, or for creating that type of a spot, like a little poolish kind of, you know, boggy spot.
Yeah. And I've actually seen people too, just dig out a hole in their landscape, paint a kiddie pool black, and then set that down into the soil.
Right.
And then actually fill that with like a peat moss sand mix, and then just plant the carnivorous plants directly into that. So you just got to keep it moist. But, you know, there's a lot of really creative ways about how people can integrate those into their landscapes, especially the native ones.
So that's like a faux bog, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
a
exactly.
Trompe l'oeil bog, you know, made out of yes. kiddie pool. That's a good idea.
Yeah. It's a faux bog. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I they're such important parts of the native of certain native habitats, and yet their territory in the world has been, you know, abused and lost and so forth. So, you know, so they have, I mean, seeing them in nature is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And that's part of the wonder of plants, is I feel like all gardeners need to play a role in trying to conserve and rescue and, you know, be part of. And that doesn't mean go out and dig plants up in the wild, but, you know, like whenever you find them available in the trade, definitely kind of making a little pocket area of our gardens for some of these more extreme specialists that need more specific types of conditions to grow.
So what else? What else is on your list?
Well, another one that I have on the list is I think that this could be the year of cover crops.
Oh, really?
because I think we need to teach people that, you know, you need to be thinking about keeping the ground covered. And mm-hmm. this is, you know, one of the principles of naturalistic design, but it's also, I think, one of the principles that needs to be, you know, in vegetable gardens. And, you know, Mother Nature hates bare soil. She does. And so if we are taking advantage of cover crops to go in there and plant in our gardens where we've got open spots,
right,
then I think that, you know, we're more akin to help capture carbon, provide habitat for pollinators and early beneficials. You know, fix problems in the soil, like maybe fix nitrogen. You know, there's evidence that some of the mustard plants can also have high levels of sulfur that can help deal with pathogens in the soil.
Yes, they can. Yes.
And the other thing, too, is that, you know, I learned about cover crops from reading Elliot Coleman's book, The New Organic Grower.
Me too.
You know, this is, yeah, me great. Too. So this is an idea I've had for a long time. But I think we'd also cover the soil, too, in our gardens where, you know, we have things like bluebonnets. You know, in Texas, we have bluebonnets that seed themselves around. And there's other native wildflowers out there that are these ruderals, you know, like aquilegia, you know, the columbines, and galardia. A lot of people think galardia is, you know, a perennial, but really it's more of this, you know, sort of short-lived perennial, a little bit longer lived annual. And so having these plants that are kind of self-sowing themselves in around our beds, you know, cardinal flower, lobelia.
Yes.
That's another great one as well, too, for wet spots. So having these plants that, you know, if there's disturbance or the soil is disturbed in some way, that we can come in and bring into the landscape or the garden to cover that soil, you're also helping prevent your weed issues, too.
Yeah, I'm leaning, I mean, I'm much older than you are, and I'm leaning more now toward, and I was always a cover crop green manure type of person, and that's how I did my vegetable beds every year and so forth and turned it in. And I'm leaning now toward sort of more no dig, where I'm top dressing with compost without disturbing the soil and in the fall and kind of putting them to sleep, the beds to sleep that way and so forth. But they're very established and the soil's very good in that constant, you know, top dressing with the compost also kind of works itself in almost passively in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's but that's interesting. So cover crops, because I've used a lot of them over the years.
Yeah. Just the no-till dig, like you just talked with Charles Dowding about.
Yes, yes.
Yes, definitely on that. But there's also winter cover crops that just winter kill, you know, so cowpeas is a great one.
It's a little
bit stemmy, but you know, winter kill. And then, like you said, you can put compost on top and then don't dig
right.
it in.
So, right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay. So cover crops, carnivorous plants, big perennials. I think you like fragrance. I think you like my friend, Ken Drews. I think you're a lover of fragrance in the garden.
I very much am. And, you know, I was recently speaking in Atlanta and I forgot how having a lot of these fragrant plants are at the Atlanta Botanic Garden. You know, they have Lonicera fragrantissima and they have Edgeworthia chrysantha there. And, you know, I've got some of these plants in my landscape, but they're, you know, just small plants. But, you know, I did grad school at NC State and visited frequently the J.C. Ralston Arboretum.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that I loved in the wintertime is when everything is, you know, dead and dormant or just emerging. You have all these winter fragrant plants that come out in the landscape, like Prunus mumae, the flowering apricot, and others you know, I know it has some tenderness up your way, but, you know, Chimonanthus praecox, winter sweet, you know, those flowers are just so intense. But even later on in the growing season, you know, sweet peas, I finally figured out how to grow sweet peas in East Texas.
Amazing.
You just got to start them in November and then they overwinter. So it works beautifully. And then, you know, there are other plants that are fragrant as well, too, kind of later on in the year.
I have that Lonicera fragrantissima. I have a very large plant of it. And actually, our mutual friend, Bob Hyland, when he had a nursery not far from me, he gave me that plant. And mine is, oh, gosh, it's probably 10 feet tall and it's outside my front gate. And in the late winter, if you park your car in my driveway, you'll smell it. Or if you go to open or close the gate, you'll smell it. So,
So
in the name of time, I want to just make sure we do give a little, we have a little time for some talk about foodscaping. because I know that's something that, you know, I really don't know that much about it exactly. I mean, you know, how to go about it, but I know you sort of steward this food garden there at the university called Sprout and other things. So that's one of your things that you'd like us, more of us, to know about in 2023 and beyond, yes?
Most definitely, yes, because I think growing our own food, you know, there is something about raising your own food that makes you feel alive. It makes you feel connected to the world around you, because even when things are going terrible, and this is something fascinating, I actually found an article years ago that showed that pretty much every downturn in society, from depressions to wars, you typically see a gardening increase after that.
Yes.
And so that's one of the things that we see is that, you know, people, there's something about growing your own food. So like you alluded to, we have the Sprout Garden here at the university. When I came, our enrollment numbers were down. And, you know, my boss was saying, you know, I want you to basically figure out how we can try to increase enrollment. And so I knew how important growing food was for students. And so we overhauled part of the area here around the Ag building that eventually became the Plantery, our student botanic garden. But we overhauled it and turned it into an edible garden where we teach students how to grow plants small scale. We typically do it more, and we do it, well, we teach them small scale because you can scale that up to any size. You know, like, you know, like we teach it on a small 6,000 square foot garden, but, you know, they could scale that up to do like what Connor Crickmore does at Never Sink Farm, you know, and or they could go take that knowledge and apply it to rooftop garden like Brooklyn Grange. So I think we've got to figure out how to grow plants in small areas, not using plastic and plasticulture if you want to go the route of, you know, using the landscape fabric to keep things down. Now, ours is a little bit more of a production garden, but what you're talking about foodscaping is, of course, integrating plants into the landscape that then have some edible component to them. And I will tell you too, whenever I go out and give talks, this is a common question people have is, you know, how can I integrate more edibles? And so I think we can come at it a couple different ways. You know, one is to look at some of these plants that are edible that have ornamental characteristics. Like one of my favorite ornamentals to use in the landscape are blueberries.
And I love them. That's so funny. Me too. Yeah.
And I love them because, you know, they have the beautiful flowers in the spring. They're small, but they're still beautiful and can be enjoyed. They're native. And then, of course, they produce the beautiful blueberries afterwards that you can then pick, or the birds can try to pick them first. And then in the fall here, at least in East Texas, and I've seen up too in the mountains of North Carolina, oh my goodness, blueberries turn this just like crimson red.
Here too, the red color is unrivaled by any other plant, I think.
Yes, I agree. And then we even have red stems on them that last throughout the wintertime too. So finding woodies that we can integrate that have, so again, you know, kind of going back to some of these other episodes that you've done, like on Uncommon Fruits with Lee Reich. I believe you did that one.
Yeah.
And so looking for those woodies. But then for the edibles, we can also think of things. You know, one of the tricks I learned from my friend Bree Arthur, who wrote the book on foodscaping, is, you know, you can take shrubs and use them as trellises for tomatoes or pea vines, you know, things like that, so that you're basically integrating and finding those small patches. So again, it kind of goes back to this concept, Mother Nature hates bare soil, and how can we figure out ways? You know, one of the things too that we did whenever I started here at the university is, you know, we did a Swiss chard trial. And I think people kind of thought it was a little bit crazy, but, you know, the reason we did it is because, you know, Swiss chard is beautiful. It's ornamental. It's edible. It survives the winter. And so why not research which ones grow best? And, you know, now I think that that is definitely coming full circle, because when millennials and young people go into garden centers, they are asking the question, you know, well, show me plants that do a little bit of everything. So when we're looking at foodscaping, that's our goal, is find the little pockets and holes, and also start small. You know, it can seem a little bit overwhelming to suddenly try to overhaul your whole landscape to make it edible, but start small, make some small impacts on things, and, you know, tuck in more rosemary and chives. And the other thing too is that, you know, if you're, a lot of times we have ornamental beds around our house already, and we're around that area close in proximity to the house. So that way it's not a big issue if you need to run out for some thyme or some herbs, you know, real quick and just grab them. As you're cooking.
Yeah. In the last like 2 minutes, I want to just, I promised at the beginning, one of the things we both want to put forth is that people think about propagating and sharing plants. Is there some advice you want to give us quickly about that?
I would love to. So I argue that we are incredible propagators of plants, but one of the things that we need to do better about is figure out how to propagate more gardeners. And so a couple of the principles that I teach people is, one, you have to sow wonder. So when a seed goes to germinate, it takes in water, it imbibes water. And just like us, you know, pretty much every gardener out there has had some experience of wonder in their life where they've experienced something that connected them to the natural world. And so we've got to be making sure that we share stories about plants, because cultural information is important, but it's actually the stories that connect people to plants. We've also got to make sure that we're helping amateur gardeners take root. And so we've got to make sure that we're connecting the value of plants and that we're not leading them astray. You know, that's one of the things that I focus on too, is making sure that, you know, the information we're sharing is truthful and accurate. Because you see way too many, information that's out there. Like, for example, you know, one of the things I teach my students is that, you know, some people say like, well, there's male bell peppers and there's female bell peppers. No, you know, because bell peppers contain seed, and that seed comes from like female placental tissue.
Yeah.
So we've got to make sure we're accurate. And the last thing I want to say too is that we've got to figure out ways to graft interests together. So that means connecting plants with art, connecting plants with music, with food, with beauty, with health. And the other thing too that we've got to do is that we've got to have fun with plants. I think that too often gardeners make plants boring, and they do it because they, you know, plant meatballs, or they just kind of throw some stuff in to fill a landscape. But we've got to remember that we share this planet with incredible organisms that transform the world, and we've got to celebrate them more.
Well, Jared Barnes, a good place to finish, and I hope we're going to talk again soon. I know I learn a lot from each of your newsletters and so forth, and so I'm going to give links to all that, to your blog and the podcast. And thank you for making time today. Thanks for sharing all these ideas. I'll talk to you again soon.
Yes, Margaret, it was a true joy. I really appreciate you inviting me on. And until next time, keep growing.
Yes.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.